Neil Mukherjee is an Indian-born writer from London. His novels are both authentic and harrowing, showing the heart and drama that surrounds self and family with painstaking magnification. His first novel, A Life Apart, won the Writers Guild of Great Britain Award for Best Fiction. His second novel, The Lives of Others, won the Encore Prize, and it was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. His latest novel, A State of Freedom, tells five different stories, all interconnected through India and its culture. It's published by W.W. Norton and Company. And I'm so glad it brings Neil Mukherjee to the show. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for asking me.
Absolutely. So in your own words, what exactly is A State of Freedom about?
It's about constraints. It's about the choices that severely constrained people in India have, about certain choices they make about their lives. It's about the very poor. It's about the people at the receiving end of great inequality. It's also about the striving towards a better life that marks all human endeavor, I feel. It's one of the most unquenchable urges of human life. And I wanted to see in this book how certain people pursue those urges and what their lives come to pursuing those urges, given the choice palette that they have to exercise their agency in pursuing a better life.
So the book is structurally innovative. It's broken into five different stories,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Were you trying by structuring this way to solve a certain problem?
No, I mean, the structure is a kind of allusion to the book that inspired this book, V.S. Naipaul's Inner Free State, which is five distinct and unrelated narratives. And someone pointed out to me, if I was not trying to do something, represent something about the lives of migrants, who are all the characters in my book are migrants, something about their disrupted and interrupted lives, and whether the five narratives which do not quite join was representative of the lives that migrants have, that's not a bad way of looking at the form of the book.
How long have you been working on this novel?
You know, it fell into my head and I wrote it really quickly, and I'm not a quick writer, I'm not a quick anything. So I wrote it in just over 2 years, which is shocking to me as I answer that question.
Where were you born?
Calcutta.
And you've... Go ahead.
Well, no, I was born and brought up in Calcutta. I went to school there. I did my first degree there in English literature. And then I moved to England when I was 22 years old. And I've lived in England since.
And you actually, as one of the characters, as a protagonist in one of these sections, do you travel quite often back?
I do, not quite often. I try and go at least once a year. And sometimes when I'm writing a book which requires research to be done, as this book did, I travel more often.
There is a lot about food in here. It's a way in which your relationship with your mother, not yours, the protagonist revolves around food, the relationship with Renu, the cook, with the country itself. Are you a pretty serious cook?
Well, I'm greedy. So I like eating. And I think everyone who likes eating has some idea about how to go about making the food that they like to eat. I cook.
And the relationships in terms of how different people cook, what it means to people, what it means to this protagonist, food signifies a lot.
Yes, it's a very fundamental unit of looking at the haves and have-nots in society. It's a very clear who has enough to eat and who doesn't, particularly in a country like India. It's a very clean marker of between the poor and the well-off. So if you ask a very poor person what it is that they want from life, they would give you an answer something like, I would like to have enough to eat. I would like to have two square meals a day. I would like to have a roof over my head. I would like to have security for my children. And it would perhaps be said in that order. The first thing that person would say would be about food, about wanting to eat enough. And many people in India don't have enough to eat. So food was a very good way of, a good lens to bring to bear on the fact of inequality.
And many of these tensions are expressed, say, between the protagonist in one section and the household help, the people who come and clean or cook.
Yes.
There are these huge class divides which you're trying to get at. Is this something that you've you're speaking from firsthand experience as well.
Oh yes, of course. I mean, of course. I mean, every Indian family has domestic help, and it's not the province of the middle classes or the well-off people only. It's a fact of life that in India people depend on other people to do some jobs for them, and this has a very complex social explanation which we can't go into now. But yes, I do speak from private experience.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and I'm speaking with Neil Mukherjee about his new novel, A State of Freedom. You've been going back and quite often. Do you see that things are changing in terms of these issues of class?
I always feel, given the person I am, that things are changing for the worse. But I'm assured by people who know better, such as economists, who tell me that things have become better in the country for a vast number of people. The thing is, you know, human life is small, and one person's life is small and circumscribed. So you do not have access to seeing all the changes that these people are seeing through big data sets. What I see in India does not make me feel very hopeful. And that's what I try to represent in my books. So because, you know, a novel can only talk about individuals and not about the aggregate.
Well, there's a small passage that you'd offer to read for us.
Yes, it's from the first section of the book, about a father who is a naturalized American who takes his little son, who's 6 years old, who's born and brought up in America, back to India to do the sites, in the tourist sites in the north of India. And they're caught in a traffic jam in a car as they're coming out of the Mughal city of Fatehpur Sikri. Encouraged by the unblinking gaze of father and son, the bearwala tapped on the glass again and made a shallow bowl of his palm to beg. Those glittering scaly eyes indicated a sickness that would finish him soon. Inside, he was too frozen even to shake his head in disapproval. At a signal from his keeper, the bear lifted its paw and replicated the human's begging gesture. The chain, attached to the animal and run through the space between two of its fingers, obliged clinkingly. He saw the head of a huge iron nail driven through the paw, or was it a callus? The claws at the end were open brackets of dirty gunmetal. The paw could easily smash the window, reach in and tear out the child's entrails. He tried to ask the driver to shoo the man away, but no sound emerged from his throat. He tried again.
And this first section from what you just read, it deals with a man who feels like a tourist when he goes back to India. To what extent is that your own feeling?
Sometimes I feel like a tourist in my own country. But I think that feeling of alienation is a good feeling to have in some ways. It keeps you on your toes. It keeps you from becoming complacent and taking things for granted. I was thinking earlier of that famous line from Theodore Adorno's Minima Moralia, where he says it's part of the ethics of a writer not to feel at home in one's home. And that's a very complex and very rich sentiment out there, which you could unpack very fruitfully. I feel it's good to feel restless and not at home.
There is a scene in the second section in which it's the protagonist and his mother, and he's returned from, I guess, from London, and he's sitting around at home, and she's fussing over him, and he starts feeling kind of claustrophobic, and he asked, you know, just for some alone time, and she says, "Alone, alone. This is what you've learned from living abroad. You've lost all understanding of family and affection and how to live in society and be less self-centered."
Right.
Do you think this is sort of the plight of the person who travels abroad?
Well, I mean, you know, certain countries of certain cultures and you know, if a person lives a divided life between two or more countries, there's obviously going to be a certain amount of refocusing needed when this person travels back and forth. So this is one of the very classic chords in which this displacement is played out.
Well, in terms of belonging and being surrounded by people when you do go back to India, do you find yourself I guess, identifying the problems of life in London through the lens of going back to India?
I I have a very weak notion of home, so I don't feel I belong anywhere. But I think that, and I don't say that in any kind of pejorative or negative way, I find that sense of unbelonging very enabling. And I would like to hold on to it rather than coming to a resting point somewhere. Insofar as I'd call any place my home, it's London for me and no longer India. But I, you know, when I go back to India and I write about it all the time, I may not write about it forever. But I write about it not because it's home, but because I find it an absolutely fascinating country. It's so rich, so dense, so complex. In a way, I wouldn't say these things about the country I've made a home in, England. It's not good material for me.
You find it easier to write about a place that you're not actually living in anymore.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, if you're sitting inside a building, you can see only the inside. You don't see the shape of the building. You have to go out to see its shape. I feel being on the outside has its great advantages, I feel. I think writers should always remain on the outside of things.
Do you think urban life everywhere is just becoming increasingly sort of similar?
Depends which countries you're talking about. I mean, in the West, in certain stable Western first world democracies, life is more or less the same. You know, life in London and New York can be exchangeable in very vast ways. And there are sort of, you know, differences in the margin which characterizes them exactly. Then certain Southeast Asian cities are the same. I would imagine Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Hong Kong, they more or less sort of offer a kind of uniformity of experience. It depends where you're drawing your line. So.
But even something like when I look at Facebook and I see my friends or relatives in India and the way that like foodie culture now, like the objectification of food and sort of like the preening about it, which feels very, you know, something if you live in New York feels. So these are things that did not necessarily exist 20 years ago or even less than that.
Yeah, God, I hate that term foodie, you know, and I hate people who are foodies and stuff. Why, Leah, I completely share your sentiment about the kind of fetishization that is going on around taking photographs of food in restaurants and putting it up on Instagram and stuff. Yes, these things have been enabled by social media, I suppose, yeah.
So how do you make it so authentic, India, that is, if you're not living there? What is the challenge in terms of the writer's task?
Well, you know, I've always thought that question about, you know, the authenticity that a writer living in a place, that rootedness in a place gives you. So the question that is asked is, where do you live and why do you write about a place that you don't live in? And I would put the question in a different way. It's not about the place where a writer lives in, but the places that live inside a writer. And I think I've lived in that country for so long, and there is an India inside me that I have access to. And I can write about that. So it's not where the writer is located. It's the location of the place inside the writer that matters more.
Well, increasingly, if you watch like popular culture, Bollywood films, the last 10 or 15 years, they're no longer the displaced migrant. They're now this sort of global creature that just kind of comes and goes. They might be in Bombay for, you know, having breakfast with Ma.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
tonight they're at the club in Sydney.
Yeah, yeah.
2 days later they're in New York closing a deal.
Yeah.
It's almost like the self-image, which has really kind of taken root.
And that's one class of migrant. And then I take it, and then I take my book elsewhere to the have-not class of migrants who are moving around India, like with a bear, say, a dancing bear, mm-hmm. walking the streets of small-town India, completely indigent people. Or, you know, people who work as domestic help for middle-class families and they've been uprooted from their hometowns or home villages where they have nothing to do. They have no work, they have no money, they have no food, they have no shelter, they have no homes, and they've been transplanted into sort of, you know, homes of middle-class people in big cities like Calcutta or Bombay or Delhi. So that's a different kind of migration, too. That's a different kind of displacement. So you have, you know, on one hand, you have the globalized citizen, you know, breakfast in Sydney, closing a deal in London. And then you have the people who are scrabbling to make a life and, you know, have the basics in life by working away from home. So I kind of try and bring both ends of the spectrum together in this book.
Did you actually speak to people who were, I guess, at the lower end, as you said, in terms of trying to understand that the daily challenges? One of your characters in the book is curious and goes and tries to understand the lives of others, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. So she, I've used her real name in the book, Renu.
Okay.
She used to work for my brother and sister-in-law as their cook, and she
this
did
is in Mumbai.
Yeah, in Mumbai, and she saved up money working as a cook in several middle-class homes to finance her nephew's PhD in particle physics in Heidelberg.
Just like the book.
This is a real story, yeah. Millie, on the other hand, who is also domestic help, and I use her real name as well. There was a Millie who used to work in my brother and sister-in-law's home until they moved away from the place where Millie lived. But I imagined her entire story. And the focal, the stepping stone for imagining her story was the fact that she came from this very poor state in India called Jharkhand, and also a state rocked by ultra-left activism and counterinsurgency. So that story is not so much an interview as an imagination, but Renu's story is based on a real person and real experience, yes.
So in the book, the protagonist journeys to the village of Renu, the cook,
yeah.
And it's incredibly awkward, and he's riddled with guilt about how much he's imposing upon the family. And yet, Renu had actually invited him to travel to the village. And I was just wondering, was this a polite gesture that he'd misread? Or was she also trying to bridge this class divide?
This is an interesting question. I haven't thought about it, actually. I think her gesture is much more authentic. She must have meant it. It was not just performative in a social way, like you say things and you don't really exactly mean to follow up on them. But on his part, too, I think it was more authentic. He actually meant to pursue it. He took it as a proper, real invitation. And the uneasiness it causes in his mother is a marker that a certain class boundary is being transgressed. He doesn't have much of an idea of it because he's westernized. She doesn't have, the cook, Renu, doesn't have much of an idea of it, although a better idea than the protagonist, because she is being authentic and she is being generous.
Have you, over the course of this book and just going back a lot, figured out a more authentic way of dealing with people who are not of the same class?
I don't know what authenticity means in this context, but, you know, there are so many dividing lines in India. There's caste, there's class, there's wealth, there's education. To sort of bridge all those together would require superhuman effort, but no, I haven't figured out a way. No, it's always on a case-by-case basis.
Some of the stories are in first person. Others are in third person. Some don't use quotations. Some are broken to pieces. I'm just wondering what prompted the shift. Was it just something that you wanted to try something different, or were you also trying to solve a quandary?
Yes, I wanted to write something different, and it's five sections. I wanted each of them to have its own signature style. I wanted to, so for example, in the final section takes place in the head. It's from the point of view of a person who's falling to his death. And I wanted to represent his thoughts or his entire life. You know, you talk about a dying man seeing his whole life pass by a flash in front of him. And I wanted to represent that in a sort of headlong rush of, you know, breath. So it had to be written that way. Yes, I wanted to have, I wanted each section to have its own stylistic and thematic feel. And they're all very different. They inhabit different people's heads. So they had to be they had to be written in different styles.
What are you working on now?
Nothing. I am teaching. And teaching does not allow me, I'm teaching this semester, and teaching does not allow me any time to think about work. I have an idea for a next book, but I wouldn't be able to start writing it before the end of the summer. So,
I've been speaking with Neil Mukherjee about his new novel, A State of Freedom. Neil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Coming up, we're taking your calls and your tweets and your Facebook posts about how moving changed your life. This is Midday on WNYC. We will be right back after a break.